Julius Caesar, Part 2. This is M.T. Bopaya from the Department of English giving you an introduction to the second part of my talk about Julius Caesar. If you remember, in the last episode, I had ended with where Julius Caesar gets murdered. He is murdered for reasons beyond the control of what the conspirators say are genuine reasons. So, in this context, we will have Antony entering to meet Brutus to find out exactly why Caesar deserved this sad end. Brutus asks Antony to return with a message that his servant would have most welcome him in all entirety. Antony enters and, on seeing Caesar's dead body, reacts with shock sadness. "O mighty Caesar, dost thou lie so low? Are all thy conquests, glories, triumphs and spoils shrunk to this little measure? Fare thee well." He is ready to die, for he thinks that his place was more apt beside Caesar, and he says, "No place will be so, no mean of death, as here by Caesar." Unquote. Brutus is quick to reassure Antony that the conspirators mean him no harm, and that the bleeding business that they have done was for the good of Rome. Antony, a shrewd leader himself, puts the conspirators at ease by shaking their bloody hands. He knows that he has to tread very carefully, for "my credit now stands on such slippery ground," he says. This is a kind of dicey situation that he finds himself in. His reputation as the closest friend of Caesar's has put him in a very delicate position. Then we have Mark Antony asking Brutus if he could speak at Caesar's funeral. Brutus agrees, but Cassius warns him against allowing Antony to speak. Brutus once again overrules him by arguing that, I quote, "I will myself into the pulpit first and show the reason for our Caesar's death. What Antony shall speak, I will protest. He speaks by leave and by my permission," unquote. Note that Brutus has made two great mistakes after the death of Caesar. The first one being his refusal to let Antony be slain along with Caesar, and now his consent to Antony's request to speak at the funeral. After the exit of his conspirators, Mark Antony shows his true colors and takes a pledge with these lines. I quote, "O pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am meek and gentle with these butchers. Thou art the ruins of the noblest man that ever lived in the tide of times. Woe to the hand that shed this costly blood." It is obvious that Mark Antony is bursting with revenge, and he is all out to see that Caesar's death is avenged. "Domestic fury and fierce strife shall cumber all parts of Italy," so he says. Then we come to the important scene called the Forum scene. The Roman people want to know the reason for the killing of Caesar, and this presents a relative and restive crowd which gathers at the Forum. A Forum was a place of public meetings in ancient Rome. Brutus promises to tell how the assassination of Caesar was essential for the state. Brutus begins his speech, and at the very beginning, he makes it clear that he did have great love for Caesar. But his love for Rome was greater than his love for Caesar. "Not that I loved Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more," quote and unquote. He says that Caesar would never have made a good ruler and would have become a cruel ruler by enslaving the Romans. In a clever manner, Brutus asks the Roman crowd, "Who is here so base that would be a bondman?" The mob obviously replies that none of them would like to be a slave. Therefore, Brutus says, none has been offended. Continuing, he says that the reasons for his death have been recorded in the office. Caesar's good qualities have not been played down, nor his wrong deeds exaggerated. Before long, Antony enters with Caesar's body, and Brutus asks the Romans to listen to Antony's speech. In a dramatic manner, Brutus threatens to kill himself if he claims that the people of Rome want him to. This moves the plebeians, who begin to chant, "Live, Brutus, live, live," unquote. Satisfied that he has made an impression, or so he thinks that he has made an impression on the Roman minds, Brutus departs, confident that he has had the people on his side. Now begins Antony's speech. Antony begins his speech by telling the crowd that he has come to bury Caesar and not to praise him. The evil done by men lives after them, and the good is often buried with the bones. The noble Brutus, Antony goes on, had said that Caesar was ambitious. Antony makes no direct comment. If Caesar had been ambitious, as Brutus has suggested, it was certainly a serious fault, and Caesar had paid a heavy price for that. Brutus and his friends, Antony insists, are honorable men. This sarcastic line is followed by a reference to his love for Caesar. "He was my friend, faithful and just to me," unquote. After paying a hollow compliment to Brutus, Antony spells out and tries to prove Caesar's worthy actions. Caesar had brought many captives to Rome and enriched the state treasury, that is, general coffers in Shakespearean parlance. With a ransom, Antony asks if this can be called ambition. Yet, he goes on, Brutus says Caesar was ambitious and Brutus is an honorable man. By now, Antony is sure that his speech has had the desired effect on the crowd, for he begins to praise Caesar directly. On the day of the Lupercal, Caesar has offered the kingly crown and he thrice refused it. Antony now puts a rhetorical question. Was this ambition? But quickly adds, yet Brutus says he was ambitious and surely they were all honorable men. Towards the end of the speech, Antony gets emotional and, with the motive of feeling the pulse of the people, breaks down. "O judgment, thou hast fled to Brutus' beasts and men have lost their reason. Bear with me, my heart is in the coffin there with Caesar. And I must pause till it come back to me," unquote. Antony's expression of grief seems to have had the desired effect on the Roman mob, for they now begin to show signs of pity for Antony. "Poor soul, his eyes are red as fire with weeping," comments one plebeian. Another feels that injustice has been done to Caesar. At this stage, Antony mentions a parchment that he has found in Caesar's study room. The parchment is Caesar's will. Note that he makes the Romans curious about the will. "Let but the commons hear this testament, which, pardon me, I do not mean to read. And they would go and kiss dead Caesar's wounds and dip their napkins in his sacred blood," unquote. He says that if he read out the will to the people, and being men, hearing the will of Caesar, it'll inflame you, it'll make you mad, unquote. Antony succeeds in rousing the curiosity of the Roman mob to such an extent that he begins to shout, the crowd begins to shout, the will, we will hear Caesar's will." Antony begins by drawing the attention of the mob to Caesar's cloak and then goes on to refer to the holes made by the conspirators in Caesar's cloak. "Look, in this place ran Cassius' dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. But the most unkindest cut of all was the one made by Brutus." Brutus was an intimate friend of Caesar, and so his blow hurt Caesar most. And then, quite dramatically, there's another quotation that I'd like to bring to your notice. "Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. Then I and you and all of us fell down." Now, the Roman mob openly show their feelings and begin to weep for Caesar. The mob begins to shout for revenge. Mark Antony continues to give the Roman mob the reasons for the greatness of Caesar. But he refers once again to the conspirators by calling them wise and honorable men, to make his position very safe. Antony claims that he is a simple man with no power of speech like Brutus. He obviously is underplaying his prowess at public speaking. Antony then tells them that Caesar has left every Roman 75 drachmas. In addition to the money, Caesar has been donating all, rather has donated to the public all his personal gardens and parks. Now the Roman mob becomes violent and screams for revenge. They want to burn the body of Caesar in the forum, and with pieces of burning wood from Caesar's pyre set the conspirators' houses on fire. They rush away to avenge Caesar's murder. Then, says Antony in a very mischievous and confident mood, "Mischief, thou art afoot. take thou what course thou wilt, unquote. The next scene is very brief, and it is a comic scene which provides a comic relief, as we call it in Shakespearean parlance. Generally, in Shakespeare's tragedies, a highly serious scene is followed by a comic scene. The scene is important from another point of view because it shows how Antony's speech has inflamed the fickle-minded crowd. In a street of Rome, a poet by name Cinna is stopped by the angry plebeians. He is on his way to Caesar's funeral. The plebeians want to know his name and address and whether he is married or single. He answers them that his name is Cinna. As Cinna is the name of a conspirator too, the mob mistakes him for Cinna the conspirator and attacks him. When he pleads that he is Cinna the poet, they beat him for his bad poetry. The mob then moves on to down the houses of the conspirators and burn them. In Act 4, what is important is that some months have elapsed. Antony, Octavius and Lepidus have formed the triumvirate. They are a group of three men in power. They are also seen seated at a table and discussing what next. They've also planned about defeating armies of Brutus and Cassius in battle. Octavius suggests that the brother of Lepidus must be put to death. Lepidus consents. Antony agrees to include his nephew Publius among the men to be killed. He sends Lepidus to fetch Caesar's will. Moving on, in scene 2, we have the scene where there is a camp near Sardis where Brutus and Lucilius are in conversation. Now, without much ado, let us go on to a next important scene in where Cassius and Brutus quarrel. This is called the quarrel scene just before the Battle of Philippi. Cassius soon enters and tells Brutus that he has behaved unjustly towards him. Brutus replies that he does not wrong even his enemies. Then how could he wrong a brother, he asks. Cassius retorts that beneath his sober appearance of Brutus, there is ill will. Brutus says that it would be improper to quarrel before the armies present, because the armies would see true friends between them yet quarreling. The two of them go into the tent for a conference. Now, the importance of this scene is that it introduces us to a change in the relationship between Brutus and Cassius. Note how cool and sober Brutus is, whereas Cassius is impatient and ill-tempered. This quarrel between the two important leaders has far-reaching consequences. In the next scene, Cassius accuses Brutus of some specific details. He accuses Brutus of having accused and punished Lucius Pella for having taken bribes from the Sardinians. Brutus has not paid any attention to the letter written by Cassius asking him to excuse Pella. Then we have also Brutus remarking that the Ides of March, they made Caesar bleed for injustice. Should a man who slew the foremost of men, Caesar that is, for supporting robbers now sell possessions for a worthless thing like gold? He says, I had rather be a dog and bay at the moon than that of Brutus. This angers Cassius even more, and Cassius declares that being a more experienced soldier, he is abler than him. Brutus to decide what should be done, and when Brutus tells him that he will not submit to his rash temper and that he is not afraid of a madman's looks. In future, he will laugh at Cassius when he is full of bitter words. He sarcastically says that he will learn from Cassius how to be a soldier. Cassius comments that even Caesar would have amused his anger their arguments. Cassius threatens to kill Brutus, but Brutus is not impressed, for he says, and I quote, there is no terror, Cassius, in your threats, for I am armed so strong in honesty that they pass by me as the idle wind, which I respect not. Then Brutus reminds Cassius that his request for certain sums of gold has not been respected by him. Brutus states that he can never raise money through unfair means, and when he sent his messenger to Cassius for gold to pay for his army, his request was refused. At this point, we notice a slight change in Cassius's attitude towards Brutus. Cassius denies having refused Brutus, and he says that the messenger who had taken his answer back had misinterpreted it all. He says that a true friend should not make much of his friend's faults. Note that Cassius is on the defensive now and becomes emotional, offering Brutus his bare chest to stab. Now, there is a note of reconciliation immediately struck between both Brutus and Cassius, where they try to pacify each other, and this is gradually whittles down to having a compromise-like situation between Brutus and Cassius. In the meanwhile, Brutus tells Cassius that Portia is dead. And moved by this, Cassius says he escaped death at Brutus' hands because in his sorrow, Brutus could have killed him, etc. Next, they discuss about battle strategy. Brutus has shared and heard that Antony and Octavius are planning an attack on them, and they are said to be marching towards Philippi with a strong army. Brutus and Cassius also come to know about 100 senators that have been put to death by the triumvirate, etc. Now let us just turn to Caesar's ghost next. Brutus tries to read himself to sleep, but is unable to do so. He hears a sudden sound and suddenly sees a ghost in his tent. Ha! Who comes here? I think it is the weakness of mine eyes that shapes this monstrous apparition, unquote. Brutus asks the apparition to give his identity, and then Brutus replies, "Thy evil spirit, Brutus." The ghost tells Brutus that they will meet again at Philippi, and saying so, it vanishes. Brutus, in panic, awakens his servant boy and the two soldiers, but they deny having seen anything. Note that the ghost is visible only to Brutus, and it is Caesar's ghost, the man he killed for justice, or so-called justice. Much of the scene is taken up by a quarrel between Brutus and Cassius. Cassius looks like the man who has no control over his emotions, whereas Brutus appears far more composed. Instead of this unity and the noble goal of liberty, we have in this scene an ironic picture of Rome divided in itself. The next point you must note is that Shakespeare has also introduced Caesar's ghost with an air of mystery, because we are not sure whether it is real or it is visible to others or it is only a dream. Obviously, the dramatist wanted to emphasize the importance of Caesar's personality even after his death. Even the title of the play suggests this point, though Caesar appears for a brief period of time. In the last act of this play, the scene of action shifts to the plains of Philippi, where Octavius and Antony are in consultation. Octavius is glad that the enemy forces are coming down from the upper regions to challenge them on the plains. They seem to have accepted there, where Octavius and Antony challenge even before they could be called so. Antony replies that he is aware of the secret moves. "I am in their bosoms," he says. The enemy would actually be happy to be elsewhere, and that is where they only put up a show of fearful bravery. And then they have exchanged a few words just before the battle. This is what happens, where Brutus says, "Words before blows. Is it so, countrymen?" Octavius says, "Not that we love words better as you do." Brutus says, "Good words are better than bad strokes, Octavius." Antony replies, "In your bad strokes, Brutus, you give good words. Witness the hole you made in Caesar's heart, crying, 'Long live, hail, Caesar.'" Antony is being very sarcastic here. And as this continues, Antony calls the conspirators villains for having pretended to be Caesar's best friends and then stabbing him in the back like cowards. "Villains, you did not when your wild daggers hacked one another in the sides of Caesar. You showed your teeth like apes and frowned like hounds and bowed like bondmen kissing Caesar's feet, whilst damned Casker, like a cur behind, struck Caesar in the neck," unquote. So hence, the battle begins, and at the end of the battle scene, we have a short scene where Brutus asks Messala to take some written orders to Cassius on the other side of the battlefield, in which he has given some battle plans, etc. Now, after the Battle of Philippi, what is important is the death of Cassius and Brutus. Cassius, Messala, arriving soon, Brutus enters to see where the body of Cassius is already lying dead. Cassius has lost all hope and faith and has asked Pindarus to keep his promise and take the sword that killed Caesar to run it into his own stomach. Pindarus stabs Cassius and thus ends Cassius's life. Soon Brutus, after entering, sees Cassius's body and is shocked. This makes Brutus remark that the ghost of Julius Caesar is seeking revenge on the conspirators. O Julius Caesar, thou art mighty yet. Thy spirit walks abroad and turns our swords in our own proper entrails. Unquote. These words from Brutus proves to be very dramatic. Brutus laments the death of Cassius, calling him the last of all the Romans, being impossible that Rome should ever breed against so noble and valiant a man as he. He orders the men to send the body to the island of Thessos for burial so that Cassius's death does not dishearten his troops. They then leave the scene to get ready for the next part of the battle. In the next scene, the scene opens with Brutus asking his soldiers not to give up in the fight yet. A fight ensues and Lucilius pretends to be Brutus so that the actual Brutus escapes capture. The enemy soldier fall to his trick and they think that they have captured Brutus. In the meanwhile, Antony enters and tells his soldiers that they have captured Lucilius and not Brutus. He then sends his soldiers to look for Brutus and report on how Octavius is doing. The last scene, you have a tired and defeated looking Brutus, trudging along with three of his surviving soldiers. They rest a while to gather their wits, and then Brutus says, "Slaying is the word, it is a deed in fashion." Unquote. These lines mean that Brutus is contemplating suicide, as was the case with Cassius and Titinius. Both Dardanius and Clitus refused to kill their master. Brutus does not pay any attention to Clitus's warning that the enemy forces are just round the corner, because he has decided to end his life. He bids his farewell to friends and then, after they have left, asks Strato to hold his sword so that he could run into it, and thus ends his life. Antony, Octavius and the others enter in a glowing tribute to Brutus. Antony says, "This was the noblest Roman of them all. All the conspirators, save only he, did what they did in envy of great Caesar. His life was gentle and the elements so mixed in him that might stand nature stand up and say to all the world, this was a man." Octavius calls for a decent and respectful burial befitting a noble Roman and a great soldier. So the play ends on a very cautious note, because in the end of the play, good has prevailed over evil. Now, see how the play is entitled. The play is named after Julius Caesar, but curiously enough, we find that Caesar appears in only three scenes. On the other hand, Brutus is present throughout the play, and his character is more complex than that of Caesar. Naturally, the question arises, should not the play have been named after Brutus? Julius Caesar is something more than a conflict between two men and the defeat of one of them. For Brutus himself says, "We all stand up against the spirit of Caesar." Unquote. Caesar, as we see him in the play, is arrogant, physically weak, subject to the falling sickness, and deaf in one ear. But it must be remembered that in spite of these shortcomings, Caesar is immensely popular. And the whole people, the mob, the crowd, they all worship him. So the struggle in the play is not just between the principles of dictatorship and republicanism. The conspirators kill Caesar, but they only kill the weak body, not the spirit of Caesar. This is because Caesar's spirit is all-pervading, thirsting for revenge, and Mark Antony declares that Caesar's spirit will plunge Rome in civil war and bloodshed. Throughout the second half of the play, we feel the presence of Julius Caesar, for there are numerous references to him. Moreover, the ghost of Caesar appears before Brutus, and this has a telling effect on the conspirators during the course of the Battle of Philippi. So, Caesar dead proves more powerful than Caesar alive, for the conspirators themselves realize this, and the spirit of Caesar lives on though Antony and Octavius Caesar. So in the end, as I said, Mark Antony's speech-making ability, his qualities as a soldier, all prevail over the conspirators. Brutus, though basically a decent human, turns out to be a person, a character, who can't quite read the qualities required to be a shrewd leader. Whereas Cassius, on the other hand, a lean and hungry-looking Cassius, is quite able to call and bring about a fix in the quality that you bring about in Julius Caesar.